In this lecture, I would like to provide a very brief and, I'm afraid, superficial introduction to the biology, that is, the physiology and the anatomy, that lies behind and that provides the scientific basis for natural family planning, for the methods that we've already described. I apologize in advance to those of you with background in the health sciences and in medicine for the very superficial nature about what we're about to do, as well as to those who know or teach natural family planning, because this is not an adequate introduction. It's simply a very, very brief overview. And I apologize as well to those of you who don't have those kinds of backgrounds, because it may seem to you that the material is rather complex. So what we're going to do is just let us know in general that there is a scientific basis and give a kind of a sense of where this lies in regard to the underlying physiology without an attempt to provide a real introduction to this very important subject. I should mention that the kind of thing that one would get in a class on natural family planning can be accessed through the link at the very top of this page marked PowerPoint for Seminarians. This is a PowerPoint that is used by a natural family planning teacher, a teacher of the symptothermal method, who comes into the class that I teach at the seminary and provides an introduction for the seminarians. This would give you an idea of the kind of thing that a couple or an individual would be shown as an introduction to this course if they were going to a formal class. If we drop down to number one, the biology of human fertility and NFP, I've given you three pictures labeled 1.1, 1.12, and 1.13. The first two, the colored ones, are drawings, that is, paintings, that are based on anatomical accuracy, but are also attempts to use what one sees in a way of teaching. And so what you're seeing here is a very stylized depiction of these organs. On the right-hand side, you can see that you have the uterus, the two ovaries, and the fallopian tubes rather coiling sinuously above the ovaries with a kind of an almost trumpet or fan-like with little finger-like extensions over each ovary, shown in, as it were, three dimensions, and then beneath it, a cross-sectional cut through these same organs. Then on the left, a rather more schematic attempt to depict fertilization and transportation through the fallopian tubes leading up to the process of implantation of the embryo in the lining of the uterus called the endometrium. There's also a more stylized depiction which gives greater detail, but is of course not, doesn't even attempt to be anatomically accurate, below these two, which is diagram 1.13. Well, let's look at them now in a little bit of detail. If we look at number 1.1.2, female reproductive anatomy, again in the three-dimensional depiction, this will give you an idea of the relationship between the uterus and then below, at the very bottom of the uterus, the opening into the uterus, the cervix, which is where the cervical mucus is produced, that produces, that it's not the only place, some of it is produced further up in the uterus as well, but this is the basis of the mucus symptom, and we'll talk about the physiological aspect of this in a bit. One can see, again, if you look at the three-dimensional portion, the uterus in the center, the two ovaries, and then the fallopian tubes to either side. The cross-sectional schematic, which is below that, gives one a better idea of the cervix, the opening into the uterus, and you can see that there's an attempt to depict the cervical crypts, the little small slashes or holes in which the cervical mucus is produced. There's also an attempt to depict what is happening in the ovary as the hormones cause the egg within the ovary to ripen and be prepared each month, and then to be released, to be drawn up into the fallopian tube where fertilization takes place. I ought to mention, as I believe we've mentioned in one previous lecture, that when a woman is born, she has all the eggs that she will ever have waiting, as it were, within the ovary and preparing for the hormonal stimulation that each month causes one of the eggs to ripen and be prepared for the possibility of fertilization. In the left hand, a slightly more schematic diagram, you have again a cross-section of the uterus, fallopian tubes, and ovary. And you can see that in that, the ovary is depicted as having a kind of a defect in the upper right, which is turning a little bit yellow. That is the follicle from which the egg has been released. The egg is depicted as migrating up into the fallopian tube, and on the right-hand side is given an enlargement of the egg as it begins to divide, forming a morula, a kind of a little cluster, as it were, like a raspberry, which then opens out and becomes the three germ layers, the three recognizable clusters of tissue that will become different parts of the developing embryo. And you can see that in the lower portion of that slide, it's depicted as the embryo is depicted as having implanted within the wall of the uterus, within the endometrial lining of the uterus. If we now move down to the more schematic drawing labeled 1.1.3, fertilization and implantation, this again is an attempt to show not in anatomical size, but to give a more schematic idea of what happens. You can see that in the ovary, the follicle, the graafian follicle, is gradually maturing. If you look at it sort of counterclockwise, from a very small little single cell to a larger collection of cells, and then finally the egg is released. And what remains behind of the graafian follicle will then become an actual organ of the body within the ovary, called a corpus luteum, because it has a yellowish appearance, which then will produce the hormone progesterone under the influence of hormones that are produced in the pituitary gland at the base of the brain. This very complicated symphony, this wonderful interaction of hormones produced by the pituitary gland, stimulating the ovary to produce estrogen, and then the corpus luteum, as we'll see, to produce progesterone, all timed and sequential in a way that not only results in the release of the egg, but then which is at the same time preparing the lining of the uterus to receive the new life, which, as you can see, this is depicted here, number one. The egg has been released and is surrounded by some protective cells. Then in number two, the egg encounters the spermatozoa, the sperm enters the egg, and in number three, the two nuclei are there and beginning to lose their nuclear membranes. Then in number four, there's been a lining up of the new genetic material as the new individual. The spindle fibers are separating the chromosomes, and in number five, you have two identical daughter cells of this new genetically unique individual. Then in numbers six and seven and so forth, the cells continue to reproduce, and those represent stages, but you can notice that next to number seven, it's at about 4 days that the egg has reached the outer edge of the developing embryo reaches the outer edge of the uterus, and then sometime between, and here in this diagram it's depicted as being 8 and 9 days, that's in numbers 8 and 9, it's actually between 5 and 6 days that you begin to have implantation within the wall of the uterus. That's slightly confusing that these schematics indicating development are numbered 1 through 9, but above them are the days at which these various events take place. 4 days for entrance into the uterus, or beginning to enter into the uterus, about 4.5 to 5 days forming the blastocyst with these developing differentiated germ layers, or layers that will become different tissues, and then somewhere between 5.5 or 6, some people say around 7 days, the actual implantation of this embryo within the wall of the uterus. And notice that the wall of the uterus is being depicted as having become very spongy. It now has an adequate blood supply to receive this embryo, and there are also deep crypts within it, which further down in the uterus are responsible for producing the fertile type mucus that facilitates the transport of the spermatozoa along this, what for them is a very, very great distance through the uterus, up into the fallopian tube where fertilization takes place. Then if we look down to number 1.2, hormones and the symptoms of fertility, This diagram is rather complicated. It, as it were, reads from left to right, beginning with the dark black line, which, if you can read it, it says primordial follicle. It's at about what would be the 7 o'clock position on a clock, and it reads then from left to right, reaching over to the other black line, which is right next to the words degenerating corpus luteum. What this diagram is attempting to show are at the top the fact that you have influence on the ovary. That's an attempt to depict what is happening within the ovary. That is the cell that is being produced, the Graafian follicle that is expanding, and then finally towards the middle, the egg being released from the follicle. All of this is under the influence at the very top of these kind of brownish grayish schematized hormones, the FSH and LH, the follicle stimulating hormone, and then the luteinizing hormone that acts specifically on the cells left behind when the egg is released in the ovary, and that becomes the corpus luteum, which produces the hormone progesterone. So there's a top kind of series that depicts the changes in the follicle becoming a corpus luteum, becoming this yellowish body that will produce the hormone estrogen. Then under that, depicted in blue and yellow, is an attempt to show schematically the relative amounts of the two hormones. Estrogen by itself at the very beginning of the cycle, from the time of the woman's onset of her menstrual cycle, and then the beginning of the development of the lining of the endometrium, that is the lining of the uterus. You can see that depicted below this, the words estrogen and then estrogen plus progesterone. That's an attempt to show the gradual increasing thickness of this lining of the uterus as it prepares to receive new life. It acquires more blood vessels, it becomes more spongy. There are these crypts which are also responsible for the production of the mucus that allows for fertility, that allows for the transport of the sperm, and you can see that this is showing, again, schematically, that you have estrogen alone at the beginning of the cycle, and then a mixture of estrogen and progesterone later on, responsible for the development of the uterine, the uterine lining, and then also responsible for the decrease in size, and then eventually the sloughing of the endometrial lining, which results in menstruation in the onset of the woman's period. And then, of course, the cycle begins anew. So as there is this beautifully complex movement of hormones produced both by the pituitary, then produced as a result of the hormones that the pituitary produces, both by in the ovary itself, and then by the corpus luteum, the cells that were formerly nourishing and sustaining the egg that was released, all of this in a very interwoven way, preparing the lining of the uterus for the possibility of implantation. And then if fertilization does not take place, then there is a sloughing of the lining and a beginning of the cycle again. One can also see here, as it were, the bases of the two methods of natural family planning, the two principal ones that we've described. The symptothermal method that primarily emphasizes the temperature measurement, although it does, as we've said, also acknowledge and encourage the woman to be aware of the other symptoms, but the change in temperature is primarily due to these hormonal changes that we see depicted here in blue and yellow. The mucus symptom is, as you would guess, simply the result of the mucus that is produced in the cervical crypts. And the reason that this is a perfectly acceptable and indeed excellent method of family planning is that it actually lets the woman know when she has the kind of mucus present that will transport the sperm and allow fertilization to take place. Because without fertile mucus, there cannot be fertilization. There must be fertile type mucus, or even if the woman ovulates, the sperm will not be able to go to the egg in the fallopian tubes. So these two different methods depend on two different aspects of the cycle. Number one, the temperature method, primarily letting one know about the hormonal changes within the woman's whole body, and the mucus method, looking specifically at the mucus, which is responsible for fertility. If we then drop down to the next chart, labeled 1.2.2, this is a correlation between the hormones. Here, estrogen or estradiol is listed in black, and progesterone is listed in red. You can see here more accurately depicted what was artistically depicted in colors in the slide above. And these are based on actual measurements by Dr. Hilgers in one of his many studies. And he is here correlating the hormones of the woman's cycle with the observations that are made in the Billings or the Creighton method, that is to say the mucus method, which only looks at the mucus symptom. And at the top of the chart you can see these little colored tabs, which are the stickers that a woman puts on the chart as her way of keeping track of her fertility. The red stickers indicating that her period is present, with little indications, letters or symbols below that, that indicate whether the period is light or heavy, whether the bleeding is light or heavy. Then green stickers that indicate the presence of non-fertile type mucus. White stickers with a baby on them, fairly clear that this is fertile mucus, which has a different quality. It's stretchy. It's like egg white. A woman can very easily be enabled to recognize this particular kind of mucus. And then leading over to the reappearance with the green stickers of the non-fertile type mucus. And you can see that this is an attempt to correlate the hormonal changes with the changes in the mucus symptom itself. I should mention that although we haven't said a lot about ovulation per se, about the actual release of the egg, this of course is very important. It's not possible for fertilization to take place unless one has both ovulation and the presence of fertile type mucus. The timing of ovulation can't be determined with absolute accuracy using either method, but it is very closely correlated to the event called the peak symptom, which we don't need to go into here, but which is marked on a woman's chart in both the Billings or Creighton methods and also in the symptothermal methods. And so if we now move down to section 2, the two principal methods of natural family planning, this is simply an opportunity to look at how a woman actually charts using the two different methods. And again, we don't need to go into the details. Just looking very generally at number 2.1, the symptothermal chart, the black line with the dots is the actual measurement of the woman's temperature, which, as I mentioned, is done every morning. Just at the very moment, as soon as she wakes up, so that it's done at the same time each day. It's not an ordinary temperature measurement. That is, it can't be done with an ordinary fever thermometer. It requires a thermometer, generally a digital thermometer these days, with higher and more careful gradations so that one can measure, as you can see there, much more specific and much more much smaller incremental changes in temperature. And you can see that this chart demonstrates a kind of a movement, a lower temperature measurement, and then a rise up. You can see that three high temperatures have been circled, and there's a significance to that which we won't go into in terms of the woman being aware of her fertility. But near those three circles you can also see MMM marked, and that's the noting of the presence of fertile type mucus, which is also recorded in this method. But again, it's primarily a method that emphasizes the temperature measurement. The X's above indicate days of intercourse, so you can see from this that the couple is using the method to avoid pregnancy because they are having intercourse on the days when the woman would not be fertile. The number 2.2 is the very simple Billings chart with its explanation that one finds in the book, The Ovulation Method, which is an attempt to teach the method to people who simply buy the book. The Billings are convinced that one can learn this method even if one lives in a part of the world where there are no formal classes, where it isn't possible to get formal instruction in these methods. And You can see that it shows two schematic depictions. The number one is circular, a depiction of the nature of the woman's cycle, and then at the bottom, one cycle showing the use of the stickers that represent the observation of the symptom that the woman is taught to look for. Then the last thing on this page is actually taken from the teaching literature on natural family planning. This is from the from literature that is primarily associated with the Billings method, but it includes observations that are applicable to the to both of the methods. And you can look over these as you wish. There are certain physiological statements that are important, such as the second bulleted statement, the woman when she releases eggs for a given cycle. It happens only during one 24-hour time span. That's important in terms of calculating or knowing the time of the woman's fertility, that the egg dies within 24 hours, then dropping on down, the assertion that the sperm must have favorable cervical mucus in order to be able to survive in the woman's body, and also then to be able to fertilize the egg. And dropping down then to the red colored text at the very bottom of this page, this is very important, that one needs to have thorough instruction with regular follow-up sessions and the conviction on the part of most individuals who teach natural family planning is that it is very important, vital if it's at all possible, for one to have sessions with qualified instructors. Then, obviously, one has to understand the significance of the various symptoms. Also vital is daily charting. The woman must actually chart each day. And I ought to mention that for physicians who are familiar with these methods, that chart can provide extremely valuable information. As we've seen, the charting correlates to the release of various hormones, and one can know exactly what's going on in a woman's body without necessarily having to do hormonal studies, simply by looking at a chart of a woman who is accurately and faithfully charting her her method of natural family planning. Obviously, one has to be accurate in observations, and important, and this is a point that we will mention in our description of the benefits of natural family planning, there has to be mutual motivation. Obviously, since the method is based on abstinence during the infertile days, if one wishes to avoid pregnancy, or communication to the spouse, if one's trying to have children, of when the days of greatest fertility are, this mutual motivation and loving cooperation is an important part of natural family planning, and is indeed undoubtedly one of the reasons why couples who practice natural family planning have such a very low divorce rate as compared to the rest of the population. And this is a subject that we'll be looking at in a later discussion.